Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence has been extraordinarily refined, informed, and influential, I'm very pleased to say, is our first guest. His name is Robert Spencer. He is the director of a remarkably important resource, the online jihadwatch.org, project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He is a contributor to outlets like PJ Media and Front Page Magazine. He is the author of innumerable books, it seems to me, three of which are particularly noteworthy and recent. Did Mohammed Exist? The book published recently by the Center for Security Policy Press, I'm pleased to say, Islamophobia and Free Speech. And the forthcoming book, The Critical Quran, coming to us in November. It is great to have a chance to catch up with him always, but most especially at a moment like this, when our need for clarity about a phenomenon I think is best described as Sharia supremacism is once again urgent and desperate. And it's great to have one of the great authorities on the subject with us. Robert, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
I wanted to start with your assessment of the implications of what has been unfolding in the past 10 days or so in Afghanistan for, most immediately, the people now taking over the place again, a group we've known and loathed for a long time called the Taliban, and their associates, including the Haqqanis and Al-Qaeda, and even their counterparts in the Islamic State. Within Afghanistan, Robert, let's start there and then we'll back the lens up a bit. But what are the implications of the defeat of the United States that has just been meted out thanks to Joe Biden?
The jihadis are emboldened everywhere. An Afghan commander recently told CNN that this is not the end, that jihad will not end with Afghanistan, but will continue till the end of the world. All over the world, there are jihadis that are hailing what they call a victory for Islam and are seeing it as a great encouragement that the world's lone superpower can be defeated, and thus Allah will allow jihadis to prevail over whatever odds. So this is going to be the inspiration and basis for a great increase of jihad terror activity in the near future.
And when you say that, you're talking about not simply those in and operating from the territory that the Taliban will control, but you're talking about those throughout the world. And it truly is, and you might just develop this point if you would, the scale of the global Islamic movement today.
It is indeed a global movement. In the first place, you have the resurgence of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, where ISIS now controls at least 10 villages and is recapturing the territory from which it was driven out in 2017. You have Al-Qaeda active all over the world. You have ISIS active, particularly in Africa also, where it controls territory in Mozambique near some very valuable oil fields, and Al-Qaeda is active through Al-Shabaab in Somalia and Kenya. And then you have ISIS also through the Islamic State West Africa province, so-called, or Boko Haram in Nigeria. And so all these areas then are expanding amid weak, tepid, ineffective responses from the various governments involved. And so it is possible that Africa could be engulfed in jihad warfare on a continent-wide basis in the near future.
And when you contemplate this, again, some of this is psychological, some of this is clearly of a theological character. You've mentioned the confidence that they can take from this, that Allah's promise of, you know, the triumph of the jihad worldwide is going to come to pass. When you look at this, Robert, what does it mean for those in the areas that have been conquered by these sorts of jihadists? I mean, give us your take on the likelihood that we will see a return to the bad old days of the Taliban pre-9/11 as they take and consolidate power, particularly once the U.S. and other Western forces are out of Afghanistan, finally, presumably on the 31st of August.
Well, it means the imposition of Sharia, and that means the institutionalized denial of rights to women and to non-Muslims, and the imposition of draconian hudud punishments, such as the amputation of the hand for theft, stoning for adultery, which is often, not always, but often carried out only against the women involved and not the men, and various other precepts that are at complete variance with the principles that are otherwise respected around the world of equality of rights of all people before the law, and the freedom of speech, of course, because criticism of Islam is forbidden in Sharia, and so on.
And when we talk about Sharia, Robert, this is not simply, again, a theological doctrine, is it? It is essentially a code for obtaining and exercising dominion and power in the most ruthless way. So when you talk about Boko Haram and you know, ISIS in the West African province and the other elements, you're talking about the imposition of this political program. Sometimes it's characterized as a caliphate, sometimes it's not, but wherever it operates, it has as its ultimate purpose, does it not, domination and furtherance of the jihad to other areas as well. So this is an unfolding problem, in other words, not one that is by any means confined to the places where it operates today.
No, see, the thing about it is, Frank, that Sharia is an all-encompassing program for every aspect of human behavior. There is nothing that you can imagine doing as a human being that there's not a law for in Sharia, and that includes society, governance, politics, relationships between states, and so on. And also Sharia contains the doctrines of jihad, which mandate, as a command of Allah, the expansion of the Sharia state and its imposition, the imposition of Sharia over non-Muslim states and Muslim states that don't impose Sharia already, as a matter of divine duty, as a matter of one's responsibility before Allah. And consequently, Sharia states always have an aggressive posture toward those around them and are always provoking conflicts with them. And so this is really a recipe for warfare for generations to come.
It's about jihad at the end of the day, which Sharia, of course, commands. Let me ask you this question, Robert, because it's a pregnant one at the moment, needless to say. We are advised by people who generally don't know as much about any of this as you do, having studied it closely, have written innumerable books on the subject and related topics, that there is a Sharia that is benign, that is not jihadist in character, that is not about world conquest and dominion, and that the people who are engaged in the form that the Taliban embrace are somehow extremists and doing so out of some sort of, well, almost mindless devotion to something that really doesn't have standing within the Islamic tradition. Walk us through this, if you would, carefully, because I'm asking in part not only for the purpose of clarifying what to expect in Afghanistan and some of these other places, but also how likely it is that we can expect help from other nations that are Muslim in nature, but don't impose Sharia, as these fellows insist upon having done?
Well, look, it's really very simple. Everywhere you see Sharia implemented, it looks the same. And so to say that there is some benign form of Sharia that doesn't oppress women and doesn't have aggressive designs against non-Sharia political entities and doesn't oppress non-Muslims, this just flies in the face of our universal historical experience that every state, every country, every empire that has ever implemented Sharia has oppressed Muslims and denied the freedom of speech and denied the freedom of conscience in exactly the same way. And so you look today at Saudi Arabia and Iran, and for all their differences and all the differences between Sunnis and Shia and so on, their Sharia states look essentially the same. And this is no accident. This is because, contrary to myth in the West, Sharia is a recognized body of jurisprudence that takes essentially the same form everywhere.
And it is the authoritative tradition of Islam, not some sort of grave and egregious departure from it.
Right. It's mainstream, standard Islam. I think the most vivid illustration of this fact is that the Islamic calendar does not begin with what you might expect, the birth of Muhammad or the death of Muhammad. It even doesn't even start with when Muhammad became a prophet. It starts with when Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina and became a political and military leader, and when Islam became a political entity and not just a religious preaching. That's the beginning of Islam as far as the Islamic calendar is concerned.
Suffice it to say that there are many Muslims around the world who do not follow their faith according to Sharia. But unfortunately for the authorities of Islam, they're considered to be apostates. And Robert Spencer, what is the punishment for apostasy in Islam under Sharia?
It's death. And so we see, for example, Mahmoud Mohammed Taha was a reformer in Sudan in the 1980s. And in 1985, he was executed by the Sudanese government as a heretic because he taught that the peaceful passages of the Quran should take precedence over the more violent ones instead of the other way around.
We'll be watching this play out here in real time, I fear, where the Taliban will be setting upon those who not only were involved in some way, shape, or form with the United States military or the Afghan government, but were seen as failing to follow Islam's teachings pursuant to Sharia. And it will be a horrific reminder of both the character of this tradition as well as the intolerance that it exhibits to people of its own faith, let alone others, if they feel as though they do not comport themselves in accordance with Sharia supremacist teachings. Robert, this brings me to the matter of people coming in large numbers from Afghanistan to the United States. We are assured that they are people who have been vetted. We are told that they are people who worked with our country, supported us, and therefore deserved to be here. I would just ask you in closing quickly to say, as we'll be talking about a bit further with Michelle Garfinkel in a moment, but your perspective on what the potential is, at the very least, that some of those coming here may be so imbued with this Sharia tradition that they will pose a problem for us internally inside the United States, perhaps in their own right, perhaps in connection with others, whether from Afghanistan or members of the Muslim Brotherhood, perhaps, or other radical Islamist groups in this country, and constitute a real peril inside the United States itself.
Frank, the likelihood of that is about 100%. There are a lot of reports coming out of Afghanistan right now of forged documents, forged identity papers, and so on. And so while we're assured that all the people who are coming over have been vetted and are trustworthy, there's really no way to ensure that. And there's a very large likelihood that there will be jihadis who come in among them, among the refugees. This has already happened. Yesterday, there was the first report of somebody on Britain's no-fly list being brought by the British into Britain from Afghanistan. And so there's going to be a lot more of that.
And would you anticipate, Robert Spencer, given, again, the tenets, the teachings, the requirements of Sharia, that that will translate in due course into acts of violent jihad inside the United States?
Of course, there's really no doubt about it whatsoever. I mean, that's what Sharia is all about. It's about waging war against unbelievers in order to extend its own hegemony. And this is something that any Muslim who believes in Sharia is going to see as a divine responsibility, whether or not he or she ever lives out that responsibility. Nonetheless, it's an integral mainstream part of what it means to be a Muslim in this perspective.
This is serious stuff, folks, and it is not meant to be defamatory to Muslims who, like the rest of us, abhor violence in the name of a faith. But it does require us to be clear-eyed about the nature of this Sharia supremacist phenomenon, especially at a moment when we are being told we must bring large numbers of people, many of whom, I suspect, as Robert has indicated, are of uncertain character, or origins, or background, or personal history, or however you want to describe it. This can give rise to a mortal peril inside our country, and we have to be alive to that danger and take steps now to mitigate it. Robert Spencer, as always, we appreciate our visits with you so much. Thank you for your work as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. It's so appreciated, as well as your authorship of, among other things, Islamophobia and Free Speech. Really required reading, folks. Come back to us again soon, if you would, Robert. Next up, we'll speak with Michel Garfinkel from France. We'll take stock of how all of this Afghan fallout looks from the European perspective and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It remains to be seen how many Americans and allied Afghans will be left behind by the Taliban's month's end deadline. What will remain, however, is an arsenal of U.S.-supplied weapons that will exponentially increase the destructive power of the newly re-established terror-sponsoring Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan. President Biden blithely assured us in July that the Afghan army was one of the world's most powerful militaries. This proved, of course, to be as wrong as virtually every other facet of his reckless decision to withdraw all American forces from the country by September 11th. But what is true is that the arms given to the Afghan military, or otherwise abandoned by ours as it departed, have the potential in the wrong hands to be extremely dangerous. They're in the wrong hands now and headed to others around the world. Welcome to the Biden legacy. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to a guest with whom we have not spoken in altogether too long, a man I've come to admire greatly and appreciate enormously for his insights, particularly about the state of Western civilization. He views it from his native Paris, France, but he has truly a global perspective, and it's a great privilege to have a chance to visit with Michel Garfinkel about developments that are impacting truly Western civilization, Christendom, if you will, all over, and not least in a place called Afghanistan and another called Europe. Michel is a scholar of many parts, notably European Islamism, Turkey, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He is the founder and president of Colloquium. He is the former editor-in-chief of Valeur Actuelle, and remains its editor emeritus, a weekly conservative magazine in France. He is also a very active contributor to the public policy debate in this country, including through various articles in places like the Middle East Quarterly, Commentary, PJ Media, and the Wall Street Journal. We're always delighted to have a chance to catch up with him. Michel, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hello, Frank.
So let's begin with the fallout, if one can use that expression, of events in Afghanistan triggered by President Joe Biden's decision to withdraw all U.S. forces from there by September 11th. And this process has unfolded very dramatically and with very, very considerable dangers, I think it's fair to say, in Afghanistan. But I'm interested particularly in your thoughts, Michelle, about the broader repercussions of this decision. We've talked a little bit in the previous segment with our friend Robert Spencer about giving Sharia supremacists any further encouragement for their jihad. Perhaps you might start with that point, but broaden the lens, if you would, to the question of Western, you know, civ, as I call it, standing against various adversaries, including, of course, the Islamists, but not confined to them any longer.
We know pretty well how the first Taliban regime worked in Afghanistan 20 years ago. We know pretty well that on the one hand, you had the tribes who were just trying to preserve a very archaic way of life. And on the other hand, you had, let's call it the Islamist international organization, which comprised of extremists from many Muslim countries, including Islamists from, say, Arab countries or Turkey or Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, that had been educated in the West. And this inner party of the Taliban was the real danger. They were turning Afghanistan not just into a backward country with no idea of human rights as we understand it in the West, but they were turning it into a kind of fortress for evil, for terrorism, and for any kind of destructive operations worldwide. This is essentially how it worked 20 years ago. The big delusion among Westerners has been that something like a new Taliban Afghanistan is feasible, where the archaic side would be preserved again, but there would not be anything like a big infrastructure of world extremism and world terrorism. We know pretty well that this is not the way any kind of extremist Islamist or jihadist group functions in the world. We know pretty well that it's a total, complete illusion to try to do anything like that with this kind of organization. Now, the big point about what we see now is that theoretically, from a strategic point of view, from a strictly military point of view, one can argue that the West or America has not been defeated at all in Afghanistan. The firepower of America and the West is still extremely strong in the area. There is still a network of military deployment from the Gulf to the Indian Ocean. Perhaps also something will be done in this respect in Central Asia soon. At any rate, the power to retaliate or to do things against the Taliban is still very high. But the defeat in psychological and political terms has been enormous. It means what has been done by the Biden administration is simply to signal the world that America is strong and is powerful, but will not move against its enemies, and it will not protect its allies. This is absolutely horrific. Let me draw a comparison. Let's try to imagine what would have happened to Europe. Would the Truman administration not issue the Truman Doctrine for Greece and Turkey, for instance? All of Europe would have gone red at that time.
Let me ask you about this again from the vantage point of Europe. We're watching what seems to be a serious undermining of NATO How do you think the Europeans are looking at the immediate situation, notably with the Russians, as a result of this diminishing of American leadership and NATO's cohesiveness, Michel Gerfinko?
I believe, I would say that most Europeans would vastly prefer to continue the alliance with America and to stay with NATO as the ultimate way of ensuring safety and freedom. Now, what happens if America is taken over by the enemy? This is a very troubling question. And if some Europeans conclude that somehow America is not America anymore, their national interest is to look for alternatives. So one alternative might be, for instance, Russia. Russia, as it is now under its nationalist regime led by President Putin. I believe that this would not be really a good option either. And I think that it is the vital interest of both America and Europe to reconstruct what we knew a few decades ago as the West or the free world and so on. Admittedly, this is not exactly the same free world as in the, let's say, the Reagan years. Admittedly, there have been a lot of changes all around the world. But nevertheless, I believe that there is a very deep mutual interest between America and Europe, provided both Americans and Europeans remember that essentially they share a singular common civilization, the European, Euro-American, Judeo-Christian civilization. Once you forget about your roots in civilization, you cannot do anything anymore. I will always repeat what President Eisenhower used to say back in the 50s. He used to say that the strength of a country is a combination of three factors. One factor is military power, the second factor is the economy, and the third factor is the moral resilience of a country or a group of countries.
And this is really the point I wanted to get to next is, does Europe now face a crisis of confidence in its own civilization? And it's a particularly trenchant point, it seems to me, Michel, because you have been subjected, France is a prime example of it, but yes, what Donald Rumsfeld used to call the old part of Europe, Western Europe most especially, has been under the influence, shall we say, of a very large immigration infusion from countries that embrace, well, Sharia in many cases. I have a tradition of it, a culture of it, Islamic nations, yes, but more to the point, nations that have a certain Sharia supremacist tradition as well. And that is at work in Europe now, and I'm interested in your thoughts about its impact there, and in particular for this confidence, this moral resiliency, as you call it, or Dwight Eisenhower did, especially at a moment when we in the United States are being subjected to a substantial number of people from such a culture in Afghanistan, most of whom we are assured are people who worked with us and for us in Afghanistan and therefore are entitled to, you know, be saved from the untender mercies of the Taliban, but who may bring with them some of the same, certainly traditions and cultures and perhaps agendas of those that have been brought to Europe with very troubling effects. Talk, if you would, about this from your perspective on both sides of the pond.
I believe that the situation in Europe, and especially in my own country, France, is probably much more difficult, or one would say much more desperate than what you have in America. First and foremost, France has undergone a thorough de-Christianization, much in a way that America has not. Let me just give you a very stunning example. As of today, you have barely something like one-third of all babies being born in France from Christian parents being baptized. It doesn't mean that at some point in the later on they will not be baptized, but still it means that an essential cultural element of transmission now is lacking in this country. Family, as we used to know it in Western civilization, as is disintegrating in a country like France. You have vastly more people who live together under special arrangement or not, than people who get fully married in the traditional Western way. The level, the birth rate is still extremely low as compared of the immigrants' birth rate. So there is a very, very tough situation, and a lot of people in France, in fact, are really realizing that their own country, their own nation is at stake. How can...
Including a substantial number of retired military leaders.
Yes, yes, indeed, indeed. I'm not saying that at one point there will not be a kind of awakening, but any day that is passing is bringing us further from from a sound and healthy situation. So we certainly don't know. Now, again, it may very well happen that some kind of an awakening will take place. And one must be honest and say that there is a proportion, maybe 20%, maybe 30% of the immigrants or the children of immigrants who have definitely opted for the Western civilization. They may
assimilated.
They may retain their religion as a religion, but they have certainly made a decision to join French and Western civilization as a whole. You know.
Let me just close very quickly. Advice to the United States as it embarks upon, and I think you're right that to date, some of what has befallen your country has not yet taken place here. But question is, are we on a similar trajectory, especially as we have an open border to our south, which is bringing in large numbers of people from, well, all over the world, including some of these countries that may have a very inimical agenda in terms of politics for our country and its future. But any words of advice to the West as we bring in large numbers of people, particularly from Afghanistan?
Out of the French and European experience, my advice is first, keep being true to your roots. Know that national identity is a very, very precious asset and should be defended and should be
prized, I think one might say. Yes.
And praised and so on. And the second part of my advice is that immigration now is not an option anymore, because it is not, it cannot be immigration in the way we understood it in the past. Now, immigration means mass migration from countries and people who simply don't share our values.
We have to come back to you on this because I think your insights are indispensable, but we are out of time for today. Thank you for your visit and most especially for the clarity that you bring to all of these topics. It's an inspiration as well as highly informative. And I know you'll keep up the good work at Colloquium and Valeur Actuelle. And we're so pleased to have reconnected with you and look forward to doing so again soon. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Captain James Fennell.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by a man I admire immensely. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He has served our country with great distinction for decades in the uniform of the United States Navy, some 30 years, in fact, as a naval intelligence officer. He rose through the ranks, as I mentioned, to the distinguished one of captain, but he also served as the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the U.S. 7th Fleet for a time. He is based out in Europe, and we're always glad to catch up with him there. He is associated with the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with the one here in Washington that sponsors this program, but a very valued colleague, notably a member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, for which I am particularly grateful, and a great resource for this program. Always well. Captain, it's good to have you back on board. Welcome, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Glad to be back with you.
We have to start this conversation, I regret to say. While I think the focus of it will probably be on the area that you've devoted most of your professional career to and continue to be very, very much engaged in, namely the Eastern Asia, Western Pacific theater. But let's start with Afghanistan. Your take on what has happened there as a military man, as well as what now seems in prospect, and maybe use that as a segue to introduce us to what it's probably going to result in when one looks to some of the adversaries we're confronting beyond the Sharia supremacists, namely Chinese Communist Party.
Yeah, Frank, what's going on in Afghanistan is really, it's just hard to digest and to comprehend how the United States of America is acting in such a way that's dishonorable and disgraceful, to be honest. And it just seems incredible that we actually have leaders that would actually pick a date to do something and order out the military and then get around to saying, oh, we have these other folks that we have to take out. And the date was, you know, generally this 31 August, which was essentially to set up for some kind of photo op propaganda ploy that would say, look, we were the ones that finally were able to get America out of Afghanistan, and we're able to now celebrate America being free of this entanglement on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. That seems to be what the political points that they were trying to score, and it's completely backfired on them, and it's just despicable what's happened. And what's more despicable, in my opinion, is the number of generals and flag officers and senior executive service officials inside the Pentagon. Not one person has resigned in disgust over this. And that, to me, is really a revealing episode of why not one person would say that they're not going to stand by and be a party to what is essentially the murder of American citizens and friends from Afghanistan that helped us over the years.
Yeah. Resigned in either disgust or in disgrace, for that matter. There's been no heads have rolled over this. And of course, we haven't seen the end of it by any means. There's an open question as to how many people will be left behind. I've done my commentary today, Jim Fennell, about what we know for sure is there's going to be an awful lot of armaments left behind. And again, from a military perspective, what does that portend in terms of the greatly enhanced lethality of terrorist organizations and their friends benefiting from American ordnance on hardware and technologies that have been left behind?
Well, I think I heard Senator Cotton say it on the radio show last night. I mean, he's more acquainted with the Army than I am, given my background in the Navy. But his point was well made, which is to say that what the forces like Taliban and these terrorist organizations really covet is these small arms and things that help the individual soldier, night vision goggles, body armor, boots, things of that nature that they can't normally get. And so this is going to be a boon to them, and they'll be able to maintain these small person equipment for years. Well, maybe some of the other equipment will fall into disrepair because they don't have the technology and the know-how and the maintenance capability. But that those technologies, like the Black Hawks and the larger vehicles, that technology will probably be sold off to China for money or the Russians. And then the worst part of it, from my background in intelligence, is the access to all this, digital data that we had collected over the years on who was with the Taliban, who wasn't with the Taliban, and the trove of information that they will now have to be able to go and find people and essentially execute them for their cooperation with NATO and the United States over the years. So it's in every way, it's a disaster.
So you've mentioned that China and Russia, for example, would probably be scarfing up technology that would be of interest to them from this cache, and presumably benefit in other ways from the declining U.S. position in that part of the world. But what about the more intangible impact? Our previous guest, Michelle Gernfinkel, talked a bit about the extent to which we have demoralized our allies and emboldened such adversaries. Is that how you see it? And from your close monitoring of the Chinese, propaganda outline and its military activities, are you anticipating that this may well translate into greatly intensified threats, for example, to Taiwan?
I definitely think the evidence is already manifest that China has used the Afghanistan debacle and to put direct pressure on Taiwan. And they've said it over and over again throughout their propaganda and China Daily, People's Daily, Global Times, to say that, hey, people of Taiwan, wake up, see what's happening in Afghanistan. America's not going to be there for you. They cannot be trusted, even if they say they would, which they haven't said, oh, by the way. So you have nothing to rely on now. You are at our mercy, and you might as well capitulate and come under our rule. And then we've likewise seen increased exercises. Today, there's been a bunch of announcements of exercises that are going on by the PLA around Chinese waters and surrounding Taiwan. Missile firings have been tested out in the West, and all sorts of demonstrations of military might and power are being reflected in the Chinese press. That gets, it's a psychological warfare against the people of Taiwan, the Taipei government, Tsai Ing-wen, the president, and her cabinet and officials, and the military of the Taiwan. So, and again, also not just against Taiwan, but they know that they have other allies there that would want to help them. Japan has been very vocal here in the last couple of months, saying that, any attack on Taiwan is essentially something that Japan now has a vital interest in. And this now will, what's happening in Afghanistan is going to pressurize Tokyo to rethink that. I don't think the Japanese are going to back off, but it's now going to put the onus on them to say, what are we going to do? Because we may not be able to trust that the United States will be there, at least not under Joe Biden and his administration. When you see a Secretary of Defense say to the press, we have no way to get people out, and we're ordering our military not to go outside of the wire around the airport at Kabul, yet we see other small NATO nations like the Danish sending out and picking up people. I mean, that's incredible.
It is indeed. You've, as I said, closely studied the Chinese for a long time. It is often said, and certainly there is, a tradition dating back to Sun Tzu, a famous Chinese strategist of ancient times, that it is better to win without fighting than to have to engage in actual conflict. Do you believe that the Chinese would content themselves with psychological warfare and other coercive techniques if it did not bring Taiwan to heel? That, in other words, they will ultimately use the capacity that they have amassed to achieve this goal through kinetic means, if that is required. And I ask this in part informed by a report in Forbes just yesterday, I believe, talking about the massive transport fleet that China has put into place, among other capabilities, to sustain an invasion of Taiwan, something they've never undertaken. They've not experienced amphibious landings and warfare and so on. But what's your current, you know, threat assessment of the possibilities or probabilities that this will go violent in the not too distant future?
My feeling is that the Chinese use what they call comprehensive national power. And so they use all the levers of power that a nation has. And their, as you said, Sun Tzu's ideal is to win without fighting, to convince the other side to do what you want without having to pull out a gun and put it to their temple. So I think that's the acme of the skill that they would like to achieve. But they have also built the military tool, and there's no question in my mind that they will use it. And so as I was on a with some other folks the other day, and I said, you know, we in the West were kind of come out of the, you know, classics thinking of logic and if this, then that, and we kind of bifurcate things and separate them out. And then the Chinese, they look at things more like a woven tapestry. And so they go from trying to convince their enemy to do what they want through pressure of information warfare, psychological warfare, economic warfare, but they're more than willing to use physical warfare. And we've seen that in the history of China. We've seen it in the history of the PRC. And they now are more convinced than ever that, one, they have a superior military in terms of platforms, numbers of platforms, weapons of their platforms, strategic rocket force. And now they've witnessed the most powerful nation in the world kowtow to the Taliban in Afghanistan in the face of the world exposing it. I mean, they probably thought, you know, maybe they could have rationalized and said, well, they made a mistake. They're not competent, even though they told everyone they were the most competent foreign policy team ever. They made a mistake, but they would quickly correct it and roll in with thousands of American troops to correct the situation. But what we're seeing now is we're not going to do that. And we're going to let, as the BBC just said today on their front page, maybe 48,000 or more people will not be able to leave Afghanistan when the Biden administration slams the door shut on the 31st of August.
Yeah, or the Taliban does.
And so China sees all this and says, okay, if they're willing to take this kind of loss, what will they do for Taiwan, which they don't have any investment in the same way? We have invested money over the years, but we haven't invested as a nation blood, sweat, and tears over 20 years. And so if we haven't invested in the Taiwan problem to the same way we have in Afghanistan, the Chinese must be just, they will see this as a green light to take military action if Taiwan continues to resist. Then the question really is, what will Taiwan do? And I think, in my opinion, is, if you're in Taiwan, you have two choices, you know, either fight for your freedom or die and be a slave.
This is deeply troubling, needless to say, because the next chunk of the free world that China may choose to bite off is unlikely to be the last. You've been following, I know, Jim, the progress of the so-called Belt and Road Initiative that the Chinese have mounted. We've done a study under the sponsorship of the Committee on the Present Danger, China's Captive Nations Coalition, that is available at presentdangerchina.org, which documents the very extraordinary success of the Chinese in building out infrastructure that is unfortunately inherently dual use and seems likely to have been put into place with that in mind by them. So against this backdrop of the whole of society kind of approach to threatening Taiwan and for that matter others in the region and to some extent us as well here at home, and building this imperial, colonial, global arrangement that is enabling to a far greater degree, if not immediately, then certainly in the near future, power projection by the Chinese all over the planet. We're looking at a very dangerous China indeed, and I just wonder quickly if you could, the degree to which those in the region that you've worked in so long are likely to be, satisfied with or even mildly encouraged by the comments of Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, assuring them that we are still a global power, that we're still engaged in the region, that we're going to be reliable and trustworthy and all that, against the backdrop of what the Chinese are actually doing physically, psychologically, and economically.
Right, Frank. The administration has a huge credibility gap right now. As I mentioned, they purported before the election and before their inauguration that they were the most experienced, knowledgeable, professional, competent foreign policy team that we could possibly have. And so far, they've demonstrated, at least with this Afghanistan fiasco, that that's clearly not true. And so there's a huge credibility say-do gap. You know, I say one thing, but I do something different. And so even if the vice president was a skillful orator, and had experience in foreign policy, both of which she does not, it would be a really tall order. You know, imagine if Churchill went there and tried to solidify and reassure the Allies, maybe, but it's very unlikely that the vice president's going to have a huge impact. And I say that in the context of a month earlier, the Secretary of Defense was out there, and right at the time that the British Royal Navy's Queen Elizabeth carrier strike group is arriving into the South China Sea. And the Secretary of Defense is out in Asia. I think he was in Singapore and he gave a speech and he essentially criticized the British and said, you know, it'd be better if you guys would take care of your stuff. The world's needs. We have a lot of areas that are of concern that we share. Why don't you guys stay in Europe and let us take care of the Pacific? Not quite that bluntly, but it was that was the message that came across to the British. So we've already, a month ago kind of denigrated the British internationally. And now you've obviously seen the members of parliament and the condemnation that they've had of this administration for the cowardice that they've demonstrated in Afghanistan. So unless the vice president has some kind of, you know, on fire speech that says America is committed to defending Taiwan and this is what we're putting forward, we're going to shift, you know, resources and some very clear and unambiguous language, I don't see how that's going to have a big impact on the region.
And even so, as you say, the credibility gap may be such that whatever she said would be discounted. But I just have to say, Jim, that escaped my attention, the comments Lloyd Austin made about the Brits, especially unseemly at a moment when we have no carrier in the Western Pacific because the Reagan, as I recall, is now deployed in support of our, well, very dangerous and difficult situation in Afghanistan. This is a topic to which we will return with you soon, if we may. Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired, thank you so much for your time today, sir, and for your continuing service to our country. It's deeply appreciated. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us today. I hope you'll do so again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.